troops, but my talk just focused on the sort of coupling between the stratosphere and the mesosphere from data assimilation point of view. So the title of my talk is just to say the impact of the data assimilation in the troposphere and stratosphere on the motions in the mesosphere during this 2002 Antarctic sudden warming. This work is done with Saroja and Tay. So this is outline of my talk. First, I'm going to say something about the motivation behind this work. Because in this work, we use the CMAM data simulation system analysis. So I'm going to give very quick introduction of this system. Then I'm going to show some diagnostics of the 2002 Antarctic sudden warming using the CMAM DAS analysis. Finally, after that, I'm going to show some evidence or show some results of several experiments which shows the impact of the data simulation below the strut pulse on the mesosphere. Finally, I'm going to show some conclusions on the future work. So what's the motivation of this work? As we all know, in almost all the data simulation system, the mesosphere is largely unconstrained by data because we don't have enough data or have very poor observation coverage. However, on the other hand, it's well known that the mesosphere is dynamically driven by vertically propagated waves from troposphere and stratosphere. So because all these waves, they are generated in the troposphere and propagate into the stratosphere and mesosphere and break down and provide the moment, provide energy in the mesosphere. If this, during the propagation through the troposphere and the mesosphere, if you have data simulation in this region, then this waves can be better represented below the mesosphere before they go into mesosphere. So in that way, then it can have, that way the data simulation can have impact on the motions in the mesosphere. So the reason we use the CMAM data simulation system is that because CMAM has very high need. It's around 100 kilometers. And in the current data simulation system, all the observations just below the threshold, below the 1 millibar. So above 1 millibar, no observations are used. So it's kind of ideal tool can be used to examine this constraint of the mesospheric motions imposed by the data simulation below the strut pulse. Okay, so during this 2002 summer with people from the Antarctic sudden warming was identified. Then if you look at the sudden warming, during this period, there is a very strong stratosphere warming, and at the same time, at least from CMAM analysis, we see the mesosphere cooling, almost as a very strong cooling. So this kind of temperature change in different directions is kind of indicate that there's a very strong coupling between the stratosphere and mesosphere. And also during the sudden warming period, because the zonal wind is reversed, then the reversal of the wind changes the sort of filtering condition for vertically propagated waves. So if you choose this period, the influence of the data simulation system below the strut pulse on the mesosphere can be better demonstrated during the sudden warming. The last point can be shown by the following, this is a cartoon. In a typical winter hemisphere, this is a you see this kind of distribution of the zonal mean just like this from troposphere to stratosphere. So it's basically the western G. With this kind of distribution of zonal wind, all the vertical waves with the face speed within this region from zero to the maximum view will be filled out. Only waves with a sort of negative phase speed can be propped out into the mesosphere. Also, waves with a phase speed larger than this maximum view can propagate. However, during the sun warming, there is a reverse of the wind in the stratosphere. So the things have been completely changed in this case. The waves most of the waves with a positive phase speed can propagate into the mesosphere. But waves with a negative phase speed, most of them will be filled out. So if you get this change of the Zeno wind right, then you get the right filtering of the vertically propagated waves, then that way you can get the, maybe get the, can be pushed the mesosphere more close to reality. Now, when we talk about the data simulation system, we always think about three components. It contains, first of all, the model. And also, the second component is the data simulation scheme used in the system. Also, the observations. There are three components roughly arranged, organized in this way. You have observation. You throw the observation into the data simulation system. In this case, it's 3D bar. Then you have forecast or the first cast. Then you use the data simulation system to provide the analysis. Use the analysis after initialization. Use analysis for the next 6 hour model integration. Then you do it again and again. That's called the simulation cycle. Now the model you may have heard many times during this workshop. We run it very quickly. So same model is like the spectral model T47. It's fully interactive chemistry and radiation and dynamics. It has 71 levels from 0 to 91 kilometers. And in this particular version, we use the Hans quantitative dragon scheme. Also, it has all these chemicals there. Finally, we use this is IAU as an initialization scheme. Okay, the simulation scheme, we use the 3D VAR scheme. So this scheme is developed by Canadian Meteorological Center. It used to be an operational simulation system, but it has been replaced by 4D VAR recently. Also, in this CMAM data simulation system, we only simulate dynamic variables, only the wind and temperature, moisture variable, and surface pressure. Other chemical species, there is no simulation for chemical species, but we're going to do that in the near future. Very quickly, we use the observation, just conventional one. We use AMSU, this should be 5 to 13, and also do bias correction. So the right-hand side is sort of the weight function of the AMSU channel. I put the red line there, just that's the boundary of our, above this red line, no observation of AMSU will be used. We just use all the AMSU information below this one, below this one minibar. There are 2 points I want to mention. As we know, during data simulation, the propagation of the information of the observation from the observation location to other areas where you don't have observation is through the background correlation, both vertically and horizontally. But in our case, we just cut off, in our simulation system, we completely cut off the correlation between the stratosphere and mesosphere around at the mesopause around 1 millibar. So, which means this has implications. So the data simulation below this stratosphere has absolutely no influence on the mesosphere during the data simulation. However, because in data simulation you do the model integration, so the information of data simulation below the stratosphere can be only spread into the mesosphere during this model integration. So yesterday there was a question asking about how this information propagate into during Yunia's talk. How this the errors in the stratosphere propagate into the mesosphere. So that's also through the model integration. It's not through the data simulation. Okay, I'm going to show some diagnostics of the 2002 Antarctic sudden warming. This first I show the changes in temperature. So the standard way to diagnose the sudden warming is first of all to take a look of the temperature series, time series of temperature on 10 millibar, that's sort of standard diagnostics. So what's shown here is just a time series temperature starting from August the 1st all the way up to the end of November. This is the temperature in Kelvin. This is time. So just first of all, just focus on the solid line. That's the temperature near the southern pole. As you can see, before the major world, before the temperature reaches its peak around at the end of September, you see several minor warmings. And at one point I want to make is this warming is kind of strange because after the peak, the temperature does not return to its original value or just drop very quickly. Instead, it just stays very high value. This is quite unusual. If you look at the southern warm in the northern hemisphere, you normally say this kind of pattern, this jump to the maximum and drop, and like that. But this is very different. Okay, the dashed line is actually the time series at the 60 degree south. The purpose I'm showing this is that the difference of these two curves is actually the horizontal temperature horizontal gradient. This difference is always positive until around 25th, something like that. Then after that, the sign of difference just is changed from positive to negative. That's the indication the Zeno mean, Zeno wind would there'll be reverse of Zeno mean, Zeno wind because the horizontal gradient changes that according to the thermal wind equation, it would say that the reverse of the Zeno wind. On the right hand side, at the same time, I show the time series temperature at 0.01 millibar. So this also again focus on the solid line. That's a temperature close to the southern pole. This is a very nice correspondence of this. You see a lot of coolings, even 2 months, almost 2 months before the major warming. So this is a cooling very strong, then back, then cooling again, then gradually the final the correspond to this is a sort of cooling like this. So from time, this is a nice, very nice correspondence between the warming and the cooling. So that's very that's an indication there's a strong like the coupling between this stratosphere and mesosphere. Also, I also in the, on 0.01 millibar also put the 6 times temperature at 6 degrees Kelvin. As you can see, the sign of difference changed many times, changed several times before the major warming. Maybe you can see very clear. So even before the reverse of Zeno mean on 10 millibar, there are actually several reversals of Zeno wind higher up. To show how expensive this sort of company is, the best way to show this is to take a look at the time and height cross section of the Zeno mean temperature around southern pole. Again, this is time. This is height. Say around at the beginning of August, there's a minor warming, very shallow, but at the same, there's a corresponding cooling almost at the same time, but this is very actually deep. Then second warming happens, then you see the second cooling. So this, in terms of time, this is a very nice correspondence. Then finally, when there's a major warming, then there's a big drop, in temperature in the mesosphere. Now, as I just mentioned, when you say the temperature difference between the 60 degrees south and the temperature at northern pole, you would say the change in wind. So the wind change is just like this. Well, again, this is another standard diagnose of the sudden warming. You look at the Zeno mean, Zeno wind on 10 millibar at 6 degrees south. So what's shown here, this is the time again. This is the Zeno mean, Zeno wind in meters per second. So even at the beginning of August, even there's this sort of acceleration, deacceleration of the Zeno wind corresponding to that minor warming. Then it just gradually decrease decrease. And finally, this is reversed around September 15th and goes back to positive and reversal back. On the right hand side, I show zero mean zero win on 0.01 millibar. This time it's 70 degrees south. The reason I show this because only at this latitude you see several reversals of zero win even before the major warming. As you can see, this is one first. The second one actually even, the drop of the magnitude is comparable to even to the last one, the reversal. Also, after the reversal on 0.01 meter at this height, the zero wind never goes back to easterly. It just stays as westerly. It just stays easterly all the time. Okay, skip that. So maybe the best way to look at change of the zero wind, just look at this snapshot of the temperature structure. In this, maybe you can say, okay, this is high. This is 90 degrees south, 90 degrees north, this southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere. Before the major warming, so the southern hemisphere is dominated by this western jet, all from troposphere to stratosphere. There's some weak eastern jet there, east wind there. At the peak of southern warming, all the way from stratosphere to mesosphere, the wind is completely changed from the mid and high latitudes. So it becomes from positive to negative, from eastern to western. And you see this eastern jet only in the troposphere. And it seems that this reversal just extends all the way to the low latitudes and push this jet very high. And just almost starting from almost the 30 degrees south up to the southern pole, everywhere is dominated by the eastern jet. Even after warming in October 15th, you still see this eastern jet. It never goes back to westerly, as you can see many times in the southern warming northern hemisphere. So it just stays that way. Then finally, in November, it is kind of develop stronger. Yes. Oh, this is the top, it's around 0.0 some, it's 100 kilometers or 95. That's the lead of the same month.
So, sorry, kilometers, what is it?
This one? Oh, you mean the magnitude?
No, just the top of the 95.
Oh, yeah, that's like, yeah, the model of the same month. Sorry, it's not very clear. Okay. When people look at this sudden warming, or maybe the best way to say to view this visually to look at this is the potential vorticity. It's not, I mean, temperature also the wind can help you understand. Maybe the best way because the potential vorticity contains both dynamic information and thermal information. So this is on top panel. This is the potential vorticity calculated with using the same data simulation system analysis on 850 Kelvin. This is September 15th. As you can see, before the major warming, the vortex is, you see the whole structure vortex. When they reach about September 20th, the vortex is not deformed. It's not deformed. It's just stretch like this. Then finally, if at the peak of the on September 25th, they say vortex start to speed up of vortex. So it breaks up into two. Finally, remember on September 30th, the temperature reaches maximum. At this time, the vortex just has been split into very small two pieces. On the lower panel is this figure I copied from Spark newsletter. That's the ECMWF potential vorticity again on 850 Kelvin. Because in ECMWF analysis, and has much higher horizontal resolution. That's why you see lots of detailed structures. a vortex which cannot be seen in CMM. But overall, if you look at the major structure of the potential vortices, they're still very, very close. So that's, which says that the CMM analysis are capable of just capture all these features of this Antarctic sudden warming. Now, the third part is I'm going to show some experiments just to investigate the impact of data simulation below the thresholds on the mesosphere. So this is the first experiment we did. I think the ideal way to investigate the impact of the data simulation on the mesosphere is to use observation. But at that point, I was trying to find some Seibel data, but that data just goes to 50 degrees south. More than that, the data are not available. So then we decided we can do some sort of sensitivity studies. So we have a control data simulation we call IUC for some reason. So this, anyways, IUC means control run. Then we launch another sort of data simulation which is identical to the control run except at initial time, which is September 11th, 2002, we add in some sort of initial perturbation all the way from thresphere and mesosphere. So the purpose of doing this, we want to show initially you have a difference between this control run and ENSY run. Then because in the mesosphere there's no data constraint, so we would like to say if this difference would be reduced during the data simulation cycle. That's what's shown here. Again, this is a snapshot of the temperature difference between the control run and this, we call it the perturbated data simulation cycle. This is much clearer. It's 0, 0. So you can say label clearly here. So this is the height. This is the latitude. This is southern pole. Initially, you say the difference everywhere. This is initial difference this is comes from a few days forecast from before September 11th. So this is initial difference. You say the major difference is mainly in the southern pole and say difference higher up in the mesosphere. Then the data simulation cycle continues up about 9 days. They say most of the difference in the troposphere disappear. That's not surprising because you have data constraints so that wipe out all the difference. But at the same time, you see the reduction of all this difference, reduction, and if you go further, you see there's some further reduction, but you see still some centers here. But this is just visually to say the reduction of difference. I'm going to show in a quantitative way we calculate this difference, the variance of difference later on. This is a snapshot of wind structure. Again, it's a height and latitude. Initially, you say the wind difference here and here and higher up. As time goes on, this sort of, again, it's in a troposphere, below the south pole, almost no difference. Also, you see some reduction somewhere, but not very complete. But on September 29th, you see there's some reductions. Before I show this difference on different levels, the variance of this difference on different levels, I'm going to show another experiment. So another way to show the constraint of data simulation is remove all the data simulation at all. Basically, you do the forecast to say if there's no data simulation constraint below this threshold, how different would it be this between this control run and your forecast? Okay, so the forecast starting from September 11th, we put some perturbation, and very quickly, so without data constraint, there's just this huge difference between the control run and the forecast, also for wind. So this is a way just to say the difference on different levels. This is sort of a square root of a global average variance of temperature difference between the control zone and the perturbation data simulation, and the difference between the control zone and the forecast. So this think line is the IUCMFGNSY, say below around 10 millibar, there's a steady decrease in difference, but for forecast just increase dramatically. Also that's true on 1 millibar and 0.1 millibar and even higher up. Okay, for this, for you, I skip that. Now, finally, this is maybe last part of the experiment. So we want to say the contribution of an unresolved gravity wave in propagating the data simulation information into the mesosphere. The way we do this, we have control zone, we have another data simulation, which is identical to control zone, but we turn off all the squad to dragon steam, because we can't do that. Oh, okay, that's the difference. As you can see, without the gravity dragon steam, so the initial difference just stay almost the same, also sometimes somewhere it's an increase. For comparison, I put this difference between control zone and as this we just saw before, you see how different they are. Also, that's true for wind. Without gravity drag, there's no data simulation lower down cannot constrain the motions in the mesosphere. Okay, this is a quantitative way of saying that. So on 10 millibar, both experiments with and without gravity waves are pretty close, because gravity drag is not important, maybe on 10 millibar. But if you move higher up, 1 millibar, say that it can start divert. Also, if you go higher up, both decrease, but the difference is very obvious on 0.1 millibar and 1.01 millibar. Okay, that's also true for wind. Well, after you say the contribution of gravity wave, unresolved gravity waves, you want the contribution of the resolved waves, but you cannot turn off the resolved gravity waves. But then Ted suggests to calculate this sort of the vertical component of the mean residual circulation. The reason we choose this is because it has very nice connection between the W star and this F. F is just kind of forcing term, which can be decomposed into two parts. One part is this sort of EP flux diverging, which basically is contribution of the resolved waves. Another, this is G, is a contribution of the unresolved gravity waves. Then I'm gonna show this. So we compute this W star for resolved waves and unresolved waves. We say the red curve is, first of all, focus on the solid line. This is a black solid line, the red solid line. Solid line is an ensemble average. So maybe I should go back a little bit. So we did a bunch of forecasts. We choose this category which captured the sudden warming, and the category which cannot miss this sudden warming. So the red one is the three ensembles forecast which capture the sudden warming. So as you can say, during the sudden warming period, there's a contribution from unresolved gravity waves is huge compared to this one, which cannot capture the sudden warming. Then third, also, compute the result. Sorry, this is resolved. This focus on the dashed line. This contribution from resolved waves, the dashed line. So the contribution of resolved waves during sudden warming is much smaller than the unresolved gravity waves. So sorry, just decompose even this into the planetary waves and wave numbers larger than that. So the conclusion, general conclusion we can draw from there is that during sudden warming, the gravity wave, unresolved gravity waves, make much big contribution than resolved waves in propagating the information of data simulation. Okay, that's the final conclusion. First of all, we in same analysis, we identify this Antarctica sudden warming, then we use this we use a data simulation analysis, we show some evidence, the constraint of the data simulation on the mesosphere. Then in the future work, we are going to use observations maybe for 2006, 5 and 6, something like that. Okay, thank you.